Hey, welcome to Faith in the Folds, a podcast for Ministry of Biblical Studies and Christian Living. I'm your host, Kevin Burr. Joining me on the podcast today is Sam from the YouTube channel Master Samwise, a YouTuber that I have enjoyed listening to some of his videos on masculinity, femininity, and all kinds of other great things devoted to fictional characters and even some historical characters as well. Sam, thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you so much for having me, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you on the podcast. I was telling you earlier that I was listening to one of your videos, which I will try to remember to link to in the description below. One of your videos, Why Do Men Need Male Heroes? And that just got us going into like 10 or 15 minutes of great conversation. If you weren't here for that, audience members, my apologies. I didn't hit record right out of the gate. I should have. But Sam, talk to us a little bit about just kind of how you got to where, like what you're doing these days. What kinds of stories interested you most when you were a kid? I feel like maybe, you know, some of your love of great stories from childhood might have carried you on into what you're doing now. Just kind of walk us through how you got to do what you're doing now.
Absolutely. So no surprise. I mean, you can see it on my wall behind me that I am a big Star Wars fan. I have been a Star Wars fan for my entire life, as far as I can remember. I've also been a Lord of the Rings fan. I had the utmost pleasure of watching all three of Jackson's films in theater. I listened to the audiobooks starting when I was 7 years old or so. They're narrated by Rob Inglis, which whenever someone is reading Lord of the Rings for the first time or wants to reread it, I always, always, always recommend those audiobooks. They're absolutely fantastic. Other stories I was really into as a kid were the Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis, which are just wonderfully delightful. But I can't say that without saying that you need to read The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe first.
Oh, absolutely.
The Magician's Nephew is not the first book. It's the sixth book. Read The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe first, please.
That'll land you in a fist fight in some.
It will. And place. Lewis himself is reported in a letter to a young fan saying, perhaps it does not matter very much the order in which you read them. He didn't really have any designs in mind. But with all respect to Mr. Lewis, read Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe first. Anyhow.
Yeah.
And those stories, obviously, even Star Wars, are very much founded in faith and spirituality. Mm-hmm. You know, Lord of the Rings, Tolkien says, it's a Catholic story. It's a Christian story. It's a story about divine providence, right? The ring falls into Mount Doom. The final victory is won in the Lord of the Rings because of divine providence, right?
Yeah.
Frodo did all he could. He did everything he could, and he failed at the end, right? He only had sufficient strength to take him so far. But divine providence stepped in. And, you know, Star Wars is, of course, this amazing story about good and evil, about the power of love and how that is so much better than the love of power. Mm-hmm. You know, Luke's, I've said a couple times in recent videos how Luke, at the end of Return of the Jedi, throwing away his lightsaber is just this incredible display of heroism, and not at all similar to him throwing away his lightsaber at The Last Jedi, which is a movie I'd rather never talk about again. I'm sure I will. And then, you know, the Chronicles of Narnia is obviously this more allegorical tale of Christianity, but, you know, bears many of the same traits. And it's just, you know, wonderful tales of adventure and heroism and, you know, good versus evil, and just beautiful, beautiful stories. So those are, you know, kind of the three main stories that I really would associate with my childhood. Mm-hmm. And I still love them all to this day. I haven't really talked about Narnia. If there's not like recent movies, I'm not really going to talk about them, and the Narnia movies that did come out in the last 20 years or so aren't that great. And certainly not, you know, popular enough to really warrant a commentary on them.
Isn't Netflix about to come out with the Narnia series?
Yeah, I've heard that. I'm not sure how soon that's supposed to happen. And I've heard different things. I know Greta Gerwig, who I'm not a huge fan of, but is talented, supposed to be in charge of those. I've also heard that the Lewis estate is very particular about anything that comes out with him, but I've heard that, and I don't know how much I believe it, because the Voyage of the Dawn Treader movie was not really true to the book. So maybe they stepped in after that. I don't know.
It is a fair, yeah.
But yeah, I hope they do. I hope they make all seven Narnia you know, however they do it, you know, it's a Netflix series, but I hope they make all the books and I hope they're wonderful, right? We need that. We desperately need that,
yeah,
right?
Faithful
We
adaptations of that, yeah,
exactly. Yep. We need good stories about these amazing, amazing tales. You know, we are lacking in good stories a lot these days. So that is why so much of the stuff that I talk about on my channel is stories that came out 20 plus years ago. Certainly not all of it. You know, there's stories that have come out recently that I do feature that I think are quite good, but even those, you know, tend to lack the really, you know, universal appeal that I think is found in stuff like Star Wars and Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. An exception maybe to the 20 years timeline that you just threw out there is one that I have heard you talk about, I think within the last year and a half, is the animated series Avatar: The Last Airbender. Because I feel like you mentioned, you know, stories with sort of universal appeal, even though that one is set in like some sort of mythical Asian-inspired, you know, quasi-Asian-inspired world, that still has very universal appeal to
it. Does. Even that's almost 20 years old. I think that finished coming out in 2007, maybe.
Was it 2007?
Yeah.
Man,
there was a remake that the remake of the first season that came out this year, which was not very good. But yeah, the original animated show, which you haven't seen it, is, I cannot recommend it enough. It is a fantastic tale of, you know, the hero's journey, right? The main character goes on this hero's journey, taking on a responsibility he's avoided. About, you know, two other kids growing as they experience the world and learning their roles and this fight that they're undergoing, and you know, the journey of a wounded but, you know, still, you know, struggling, you know, man struggling to do good, to find out, you know, what it is that he really wants, and you know, and then you've got other characters who are just wonderful. It's possibly just the perfect show. Because it is written, you know, it is written to be understood by kids, and I talk about writing quite a bit on my show, or the quality of writing, and sometimes you know you need shows that are written for kids to be understandable by 7-year-olds. And so they need to be less complex, they need to exposit a little bit more, but the writing can still be deep and rich and meaningful, even if it is telling a little bit more than it is showing sometimes. Because you get it where the kids will understand it on one level and the adults will understand it on a deeper level. And that is the mark of just a truly incredible show or movie. Pixar did this very, very, very well for many years. So those are the kind of stories that, yeah, I love, and I love to talk about. So in terms, I don't know if you want me to keep going. I can.
Well, I was going to say, let's dig into Avatar just a little bit, if you don't mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
Avatar: The Last Airbender. Specifically, the way that you described it, I think really is really on point. That it's written for children, but it's written in such a way, and appropriately handles, you know, pretty complex themes and ideas, to where even adults, I mean, goodness, there's a few scenes in Avatar: The Last Airbender that, like, I remember watching when they came out on DVD, and I was in grad school, so, but this was like early, like 2008, 2009, so like, you know, relatively fresh, like the series is relatively fresh. And my housemates were really big into the show, so I'd never seen it before, but we watched it, and, you know, I loved it. Like, I remember thinking, like, oh yeah, this is really cool. Like, bending is pretty rad. You know, like, I'm in a Dragon Ball, so like, bending is kind of like the stuff they do in Dragon Ball, which is also cool. So like, that's kind of where I was. And then, like, I really grew to appreciate the characters and stuff like that. But then, fast forward 10 years, I'm married, and I've got and one kid at that point, now two kids. And I, in the episode, one of the episodes where they follow, you know, a character named General Iroh, who's sort of, if you haven't seen the show, he's sort of a disgraced figure, part of the royal family, was in line for the throne, but had been sort of usurped by his younger brother, is because Iroh essentially was distraught over the loss of his son. Spoiler. Having kids of my own now. Oh my goodness. In that episode, Tales of Ba Sing Se, where they follow Iroh, it's like, oh my goodness, I can't make it through that. Like, I'm turned away from the boys. Yeah, just over here weeping.
Well,
Because it's, it, yeah, go ahead.
it's incredibly poignant for an adult, for a kid watching that. You see Iroh helping, you're like, oh, he's nice, he's so kind, what a good man. And as an adult, especially going back to rewatch it and seeing him just have the wisdom to help these people, to know what each kid needs, a crying child, man down on his luck trying to mug him. And Iroh just reacts so kindly and so wisely to every situation. And it's just beautiful. And at the end, he says, if only I could have helped you, so I'd helped others, right? To his son, to his fallen son, as he commemorates his death, or I think it's his birthday. But it's so profound. And you see the you understand that this is a changed man, right? This is a man who lost his son and now just wants to be the man he wished he had been when his son was still alive.
I think that's what is
And
so meaningful about it too, is that you can see he has. Like, he clearly has flaws because of his past in the Fire Nation army, but the flaws and his reaction to them, without using the word repent, like without using the word repentance, he does, he experiences repentance, and then it begins this drastic change. I cut you off. Go ahead.
No, you didn't. My thought was complete.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's why people also like Chronicles of Narnia, for the same reason that for kind of an underlying reason, so why they would also like something like Avatar: The Last Airbender, because like you were saying, Chronicles of Narnia written for children, but then when you see a character like Edmund, for example, like at a child's level, you understand, oh, Edmund did a bad thing, right? The
Yeah,
witch
you
is
just say
bad.
sorry. Yep.
Edmund did a bad thing. And then if as an adult, and if you've gone through some kind of grievous sin, and then you get to a point where you've repented from that and tried gone on the process of healing, not just from your own self-destruction, but from the chaos and destruction that you caused elsewhere, like then you see, like you really feel the depth. Not just Edmund's, descent into the witch's grasp, and then his redemption, but you feel that much more what Aslan's sacrifice is, which the kids can also understand to some degree. It's like, the A Aslan let himself be taken, but like once you've actually experienced the weight of sin and death. Like then you can really understand kind of what Lewis was doing.
Yeah, and all of these stories have someone like that, or multiple characters like that, which is who not only fail, right? So you have Boromir trying to take the ring. You have Zuko, who betrays his uncle at Ba Sing Se. You have, to a lesser extent, Han Solo, who runs away. He doesn't really have much of a repentance, but Han, Luke fails at, in Cloud City, and he tries to go save everybody in rejection of adv his advice. From Yoda and Obi-Wan. And then you have them struggling to believe they're worthy of redemption. Right? Edmund is a great example. He's like, I don't think I can, it's been, I've done such horrible things. How can I do this? The scene where Zuko, goes to apologize to his uncle, near the end of this the series. And he's like, how can you forgive me so easily? As I'm talking about it, like I almost choke up a little bit, as it's just so perfect, right? And Iroh says, I was never angry, I was just afraid you'd lost your way. And, you know, not that Ira is an allegorical for God, but, you know, it's like, that is, I mean, that is kind of what divine love looks like. Right. I mean, and that's what, you know, humans are supposed to image to each other, is this, you know, when someone turns back to us, or when we turn back to God, or whatever the relationship is there, you know, when repentance is true and meaningful, then that's the proper response, is, you know, I was not angry with you. I don't hold this against you. I'm not, you know, holding onto a grudge and wanting to get back at you for how you've wronged me. I was just sad and afraid you'd lost your way, and I'm so happy you're back.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, that's present in so many of those stories. And it's just such an incredible thing, because it's universal. It's true. It's how we should live our lives. And yeah, I mean, I absolutely just love stories like that, where you have these characters who struggle and fail, and then who redeem themselves, right? Who say, I'm sorry, I should have been better. I wish I had not acted as I did, but now I will be better. And like Boromir at the, you know, after he betrays, you know, Frodo and tries to take the ring, and I mean, he's pretty much immediately repentant, and you know, then he goes and, you know, fights for Merry and Pippin and dies defending them. And the scene where he talks to Aragorn, which I don't think is in the book, but Jackson added in the film, and he says, you know, I would have followed you, my brother, my captain, my king.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just, you know, you're like, oh, this is a good man. You know, he's a good man who fell, you know, for a moment to a temptation that any one of us would have fallen to. But he repented and he changed, and he fought for, you know, though he fought to protect those who could not protect themselves. And so, yeah, whenever I see that in a story, it warms my heart, especially because our modern world doesn't believe in repentance a lot. Right.
Ooh. I think that that's right. Goodness, especially when it comes to any kind of, you know, like, you know, social or political faux pas, something like that. It's really one and done, you know, for a lot of folks.
So, and which is very sad, because we all need it. We all make so many mistakes constantly, all the time. So when you have, you know, our stories kind of telling us you need to be good, you need to just be a good person all the time, not that that's not right, we shouldn't make mistakes, we shouldn't sin, but we're going to have flaws that we need to overcome. I don't have you did you watch the live action remake of Avatar The Last Airbender?
No, we don't have Netflix.
Good.
But I was keeping up with kind of reviews of it.
Yep.
And okay. I'll admit I've been so jaded by remakes and reboots and things like that, that my first reaction at any time when I hear that something new is coming out is, oh, here we go again, man. You know, it was that way with it was that way when I heard the Netflix announcement about Chronicles of Narnia.
Mm-hmm.
It was that way when Rings of Power was being advertised by Amazon, and just thinking, it's like, all right, you know, first off, Peter Jackson did an unmatchable job with the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and yep. I'm in the process of reading the books to my oldest. We are about halfway through the Two Towers right now, so like I get like. He took liberties and stuff like that. I mean, yeah, right. It's a different medium.
They're not
so
perfect. Like, they will never be better.
Well, like that's a great way to describe it.
That is my firm stance
like,
on it.
It's like the way that he presented the characters. I feel like the characterization is largely true. Like, again, you can quibble here and there, but
he largely made the characters more human and less paragons of virtue, which worked in some cases. Theoden is an excellent case. It worked really, really well. It worked pretty well with Aragorn. It did not work well with Faramir. But for the most part, his characters are still excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. And Yeah, but when you, but then I started to see the trailers for Rings of Power, started to see the reactions, started to think, oh man. So anyway, I didn't, didn't go out of my way to try to, bum Netflix off of somebody to catch the live action Avatar, but, kind of flesh it out for us a little bit, because I know you've done some work comparing the TV show Avatar: The Last Airbender and the Netflix adaptation of the first season.
No. So the biggest issue, and I call this, I don't, I, there's probably a better term for it, but I call it value washing, where you basically want to wash your characters over with good values. You don't want to have them have, you don't want to let your good characters, you don't want to let them have any bad values, right? So in the first season of ATLA, the original, Sokka, and especially in the Kyoshi Warriors episode, is rather appropriately sexist for being the character he is from the environment he lived in, right? Where the men are all the warriors and the women, do what they do back at the tribe,
Yeah,
right? It's like,
guy's never
this is
seen
what he's
a
going to
female
do. Yeah.
warrior before.
No. So
Yeah.
he's like, there's no way a bunch of girls took us down. Like, of course he believes that. For one thing, he's a 15-year-old kid.
Yeah.
Of course he does. Of course he has an ego the size of,
And he's
a
kind of scrawny
warship.
too. So like there's a little
Oh yeah.
compensation as well.
Yeah.
He's tall, but
Right.
he's kind of thin.
Yeah, he's the best warrior in his village, as he says, but then all the other warriors are at most 10 years old.
Yeah.
And it's so it's just and it's comedic. It's For one thing, it's funny. You take away comedy from the character and you're really, really toning down the character. But it's also a huge learning experience for him as he has his eyes open to the world and he encounters this group of female warriors who have a lot to teach him. And he learns humility. He learns, oh, I don't know nearly as much as I thought I did, but I need to be better, right? He doesn't let his pride control him, right? It gets wounded. He sulks and then he recovers. He comes back. He says, please teach me,
Yeah.
right? And when you take that away, he's like, oh, we don't want Sokka to be sexist. We don't want him saying things about women sewing pants, that's their job, because we want to like Sokka. We want Sokka to be a good guy. Good guys aren't sexist. And it's just, no, this is what growth is. We under the show knows, the original show knows that, yeah, being sexist isn't good. Saying girls can't fight isn't good, especially in fantasy show, because fighting is, the style of fighting is, the bending, their martial arts, they're cool, they're fun, they're good to watch. They want boys and girls to be able to enjoy the show. Right? Boys and girls want to see boys and girls, showing off and having a great time taking down bad guys. It's awesome, right? It's just fun, right? So that's one of the things where in fantasy, I know some people are like, oh, we don't want it, women shouldn't be warriors. I see this and sort of comments like sort of the comments in the comment section. Yeah, we shouldn't be showing women warriors, women, we don't want to inspire that. It's like, for one thing, it's fun. For another thing, sometimes women are warriors. Sometimes women are great warriors. You got Joan of Arc, for crying out loud, right? And so yeah, there's a place for that. But yeah, just and they did the same sort of thing with Katara. I'm switching trades out a little bit, where Katara in the original is very passionate, very, very passionate, highly emotional, super strong-willed, gets a little too focused on things sometimes. A lot that gets carried away. She's very motherly. She can be a little naggy. She's a person. She's got a personality. And sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's bad. Depends on the situation, right? And that's gone in the anime series. She's just blah. She's a waterbender. That's literally her entire character arc, is learning to waterbend, which is a big part of her arc in the first season, but it's not everything. They strip out a lot of it to where she doesn't really struggle with it. She's just kind of naturally good at it. Whereas in the original, Aang was naturally good at it, but he didn't really work at it because he was naturally good at it. So Katara worked harder and got better than him. And that's just not there. Aang literally does not waterbend in the entire first season. So book one, water, where Aang is supposed to be learning waterbending, he doesn't learn it. He doesn't attempt it. So what were we doing here? Anyhow, so that Zuko suffered a similar sort of treatment where they made him less bad. They didn't make him quite as rude and aggressive towards his crew or Admiral Zhao. They didn't, you know, they toned him down less. They had to tone him down less because he is still the antagonist, but he's much less of a villain. He's still less, you know, less flawed. They made him look, they painted him much more as a victim, which he is. He is a victim of Ozai's sure. cruelty, but they really played up that angle. It's like, oh, you know, we have to redeem him, so he can't really be too much of a villain. And again, I think that's just because we don't want him showing, you know, we don't want to have him doing really bad things. In the original, he burns down half of Kyoshi Village. In the remake, Zhao does that. He burns down half of another village in, you know, the 15th or 16th episode. That's just gone too. So there's a lot that's not really present. Whereas, what does he have to be redeemed from here?
Right.
So yeah, that's all kind of thing where people or in Hollywood will take these characters that have these, you know, these peaks and valleys in their arc, right? Where their character, you know, their virtues and their vices will come into play, and they'll just kind of flatten it, right? Where their vices are just so much less, especially for heroes. But that means that their virtues, right? When they do good things, it's kind of like, yeah, okay, you just did a good thing, but we haven't seen you struggle with having to do that, with struggle with any sort of vice and opposition. So when Hollywood does this, when they, you know, show us characters, they don't really need to be redeemed from anything. Even if they're the good characters who have always been good, they still need to be redeemed from something. They need to have growth. And that's missing a lot of the time, because I think our modern world, like I said, doesn't really like redemption. We just want people to be good, 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 flat, same all the time. And it's boring.
Yeah. I wonder, in some of what we were talking about earlier, I think this is relevant here. I wonder if part of what we're seeing is an aversion to things like genuine redemption, an aversion to, because, you know, redemption, like, almost always requires, well, it, yeah, in fiction, obviously, in reality, yes, always requires repentance. But in fiction, I can't think of any examples where redemption occurs without some kind of repentance. So let's just say, you know, that redemption always requires repentance.
Yep.
But when repentance is hard and uncomfortable, then, you know, like, that is removed, or even the notion, and, you know, like, you know, maybe it's tied into, you know, the greater secularization of the U.S. or something along those lines. So those are very big topics that my expertise is not that. But, you know, if redemption requires repentance, but repentance means, therefore, that, you know, you did these bad things, then, you know, we can't allow that, because our heroes, you know, must always be virtuous, particularly the heroes who are victims in some way, you know, because they have this, you know, status of victim. And, you know, that's such an important part of their character. But the status of victim, a lot of times in stories today, does seem to be like a shield, almost, you know, shielding someone from, you know, responsibility for, you know, for the things that they do. I don't know. Is that making sense? Do you see that?
Oh, some absolutely. Maybe no, in a absolutely
fairly
no,
recent Star Wars show that came out.
You are spot on, my friend. So the discussion of victimhood, this is one I had, you know, a recent video where I talked a lot about this. I've talked about it other times as well, where Hollywood uses, like, the victimhood status to create, to try to contrive or create, just spurn within the audience a sense of sympathy, right? They want us to feel bad for someone. Rings of Power does this. In the very first episode, they have Galadriel in Valinor making a little paper, like, swan that she's floating down the river, and all the other elf children are being mean to her and throwing stones at her boat to try and sink it.
It's the weirdest thing, you know.
We don't know like why really they're weird. Bullying Galadriel. We don't know what on earth is going on. This makes no sense whatsoever. There's no context given. It's just, look at her. She's being picked on. Don't you feel bad for her? The correct answer is, of course, no. I don't know why any of this is happening. I don't understand these characters' motivations whatsoever. No, I don't feel bad for her.
This also just doesn't make a lot of sense based on what you sort of know about Valinor. As for those who haven't read into all the Lord of the Rings and the Silmarillion, Valinor is largely kind of an unstained place until later on into the story. And so for her to be there and for them certainly to be experiencing this kind of stuff. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
You're absolutely right. Victimhood is like a shield. Right. How could you not like this character? They're a victim. Mm-hmm. Right. When you're a victim and you're seizing power, you're justified because you've been victimized. Yeah. It's so much what passes as morality in modern Hollywood and our modern world at large is just oppressed and oppressor. Right. The oppressors are at wrong. The oppressed are in the right, and they are allowed to rise up and seize power. So, and that's just also lacking meaning, right? Where you're just supposed to identify with the oppressed. It's why we have a victimhood culture. It's why is that, like you said, so many shows or movies just display their character as the victim, and that makes them the good guy, which is simply not true. There needs to be so much more to it than that.
That's a really dangerous kind of game to play in the real world, but I would say also in the fictional world as well, because fiction does in many ways inform us about reality. I mean, I tell my boys that all the time. Like, we can read these stories, particularly when I was reading through the Chronicles of Narnia with my oldest son. These are pretend stories, but the pretend stories tell us about real things. It's essentially Tolkien's way of convincing Lewis, right? It's the myth made true. But like these stories, tell us about real things. And so take a look at something like the prequel trilogy of Star Wars. Anakin Skywalker, this kid who's enslaved, has he been enslaved from birth? I can't remember, but
more or less, yeah.
But like,
as far as I
know, he's like, how old is he in the, like, eight?
I think he's nine.
8 or 9. Okay, so
10 minutes, yeah.
Even still, for a couple of years, so like very obviously very traumatizing. Mm-hmm. So like he's clearly a victim of some ugly, ugly things going on there on Tatooine. And then you move over to Attack of the Clones, and like, he's still that same kid. Like, he's still the victimized, kid now, like, teenager. And like, does that justify his slaughter of the Tusken Raiders? It's like, oh my goodness, like, we can't let this oppressed, former enslaved child, get away with something like that. Like, we can't say, well, buddy, well, like, look what happened to him, right? Like, or even, even what had been done to done to his mom in the animated Clone Wars. Did you watch through all the like animated Clone Wars?
Yep. Yeah, I've seen those.
So in the episode where or in the arc where they land on some planet of slavers, it's really fascinating to see his trauma kind of come back, and that that explains it a little bit more. But it's like, at no point do I feel like Lucas in the prequel trilogy, or even Filoni in the Clone Wars TV show, at no point do I feel like they are anywhere near giving Anakin a pass for anything that he's done. Like, he still very much has agency.
Oh yeah.
That doesn't always appear to be the case with some of the more recent Star Wars that that we've seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anakin's such an interesting character. I do wish I loved, I wish I liked the prequel trilogy more than I do. Because I love their ideas and I love the world they're set in. And I love many of the themes that were running through them. I don't love the execution.
Man, the execution is tough. Yeah,
but
it is.
The Clone Wars, when it was good, it is a show very much written for kids, sometimes to the point where it's, yeah, the kids are smarter than this. It's okay, Dave. The kids understand what's going on. But it did have some, you know, some excellent storytelling at times. And yeah, the way they were able to flesh out Anakin was really, really good, right? Mm-hmm. Where you see him fighting this seemingly endless war, right? Where it's just so difficult to do anything, to get anything done, to make any progress, unless you were willing to fight like the enemy fights. You know, and yeah, you see how it kind of corrupted him, how his desire to just win at practically any cost was changing him. And yeah, so I really appreciate Clone Wars for filling in a large amount of Anakin's character arc that was left unfilled by episodes 2 and 3.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah, you're absolutely right. Where yeah, his victimhood, if anything, drove him to become a villain. Right? Not to be a hero. He was not absolved of anything. You understand him, right? But that doesn't mean you absolve him.
Right.
And that's part of what makes a great villain. It's like they have reasons for doing what they do because they have actual motivations. You're not just wondering why is this guy doing what he's doing. You know. The show that does this absolutely perfectly every single episode is Phineas and Ferb, where Dr. Doofenshmirtz gives you a backstory for every single one of his evil plots. And it's brilliant. You know, it's just so wonderfully creative. But yeah, so that's, you know, and so that's, you know, again, that's part of what makes Vader, you know, Anakin, even then a great villain, especially with Clone Wars fleshing him out, because you understand where he came from. But yeah, his victimhood status, like you said, it's not a shield, it's not an absolvement, it's just an explanation. And it's, yeah, you know, when that's so true to life. When kids are traumatized, when they suffer, they're likely growing to sadly grow up to do awful things because awful things were done to them. That's just life as they know it.
Yeah.
So, you know, believing that, you know, kids who were victimized and abused will be better, we can hope for that, and we should certainly work for that. But yeah, saying that, oh, you were, you know, mistreated, well, yeah, it's not really on you if you mistreat others, is short-sighted, because free will exists, agency exists, people, you know, do make their own choices. And as much as we should seek to understand why people, you know, do the wrongs that they do, that never means we should, you know, seek to say, or never means we should say, well, it wasn't really that wrong because you did it. And you've suffered in that same way.
Yeah, the idea that it's okay when we do it is an exceedingly dangerous idea in fiction and in reality as well. Yeah. Somebody who doesn't get really much of a opportunity maybe for a redemption arc, I don't know, is a character of Azula in Avatar The Last Airbender. We see that, I said redemption arc, I meant, you know, we don't really get a lot of detail about the trauma that she experienced growing up. Based on what we can learn from her, if she is a reliable witness, you know, what she experienced most, like the trauma she experienced most when she was a kid, was that you know, her mom thought she was a monster. But then at that confession, Azula says she was right, but it still hurt, you know. But even then, like, the writers of Avatar The Last Airbender, they don't let her have a pass just because, you know, she had let's read between the lines a little bit. Say she had a difficult relationship with her mother. You know, it seems like she was a daddy's girl and Zuko was a mama's boy. You know, I think that's a fair characterization there. Just like Zuko doesn't get a pass for his stuff as well.
Right. So, Azula is an interesting one. And I think at the time, it may have been my longest video, but I had a whole, you know, essay on Azula.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a very, very interesting character where, you know, she, you know, she, her mom's sister, and when Azula has the vision of her mother in the mirror, right? And, yeah. you know, she's Azula saying things like, you know, fear is the only reliable way, mm-hmm. right? You know, love is for fools. And she says, even you feared me. And her mother says, no, I loved you, Azula. And that's when Azula just loses it, because I think her, you know, she's not really capable of believing, or at least she doesn't believe. She's been just so broken over the years. She doesn't believe that she's like worthy of love. She doesn't think people can love her, right? And you know, and that's kind of what breaks her. She can't really believe that. And you know, we don't see exactly how she got to that point. Right. And, you know, we might think, hey, if it weren't for the influence of Iroh spending 3 years with Zuko, Zuko would be the same way, right? Zuko being banished was probably the best thing that ever happened to him, because, mm-hmm. you know, he got away from his father, right? You know, imagine, yeah. you know, Azula spending those 3 years just under the tutelage and, you know, the attention of her father, whatever that was, certainly was corrupting. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you know, I think, you know, you mentioned, you know, her not having a redemption arc, and there was a video I have meant to watch but haven't watched yet by a YouTuber named Hello Future Me, who talks about Avatar a mm-hmm. decent amount. And
yeah,
I've
seen some of his stuff.
Yeah, so I don't know if you've seen that video, but I haven't watched it yet. You know, or it's talking about redemption arcs, and I'm sure, you know, he talks about Azula there. But again, unfortunately, I can't offer you my thoughts on that because I haven't watched it. But yeah, I think when so much of the focal point of Avatar, especially in the third season, is on Zuko's redemption, you have to have something that stands in contrast to it. At least right. I would think that's kind of how the writers feel. And it is tragic. And I think that's what is so important, is that the final Agni Kai between Azula and Zuko is not this triumphant moment for Zuko. I mean, the music, just the music alone tells you that this is deeply sad that these two siblings have been driven to this point. And while, yeah, they've made choices to it, again, there's so many factors that get into it. And at its core, it is just a tragedy that brother and sister are fighting, that they're burning their home down around them in this fight. And yeah, I think that's part of what makes Azula's character so great, is that it's just so deeply sad, right? Where you understand that, yeah, just, you know, her falling and, you know, crashing and burning as she's, you know, given the mantle of Fire Lord and then just fires everybody because she can't trust anyone, and ends in this Agni Kai and goes insane. It's sad because you see in Zuko what could have been, right? Well, you know, what you see in Zuko's redemption, like, oh, this, you could have chosen that, right? If you made different choices, if you had a different mentor, I think you do need, especially in fiction, hopefully only in fiction, you need characters that are at least, you know, to some significant point in the story where the story ends, if hopefully not their story, but who are unrepentant, who do fail, right? Because, you know, it's good to have that vision of what failure looks like. And like I said, having that failure be sad, not be that triumphant, you know, again, as a kid, maybe you would, take him down, or take her down, Zuko, right? Which he should. It's, you know, she is crazy and she does need to go down, like Iroh says. But that doesn't mean it's a happy thing. And especially as an adult, you understand that.
Yeah. Now you feel the weight and complexity of what her brother Zuko is actually, you know, feeling at that moment. It's interesting about Azula's defeat in the series, and Ozai, so the big bad guy, for those who are not familiar with Avatar: The Last Airbender, with Ozai's and Azula's defeat, they're both defeated in ways not so much by being overpowered, but by being humbled by also by people who, you know, they believed to be beneath them, you know, in all respects. Azula is a prodigy firebenders. Like she can, again, for those not familiar with the show or the world, no, she has the ability to manipulate fire in a variety of ways, and even to the point of being able to shoot lightning. So like that's like, and the way that the show sh displays that is, lightning is, the capability of only a few firebenders. Azula is not beat by, a master, firebender. She's beat by another girl who is younger than her, from a poor tribe on the other side of the world, where Azula is royalty, and at that point is actually the head of the Fire Nation. Katara doesn't overpower her. She outsmarts her and humbles her. And in a similar way, Aang, although he's eventually able to, reach the Avatar state and gets to the point where he can beat Ozai down to where he can actually, kind of get to him. In the end, it's not his, overpowering death blow that kills him. He actually stops the death blow at the end of the of right at the end before it is executed, and then humbles him by taking away the thing that enabled him to do all of to do what he was doing in the first place, but taking away his bending. And so here's this little kid, up against this, very aggressive, assertive, grown man. And it's just fascinating to see how, these two who suffered from such extraordinary pride, they really do embody the, the old adage, pride comes before the fall. And that's precisely what happened with them. I hadn't considered that before, but Sam, what you were saying earlier made me think about it in that way. So,
Yeah,
Sam, let
there's
me
a
go ahead, go ahead.
no, you're good. I'm doing
Let
fine.
me ask, why do you think, based on some of the videos that you've done and seen, I felt like you would be a good person to talk with this topic about. Why do you think masculinity has fallen on hard times these days? And if in the course of that
Yeah.
discussion, you happen to talk about some of the guys that I've seen you do videos on in terms of their focusing on their masculinity, like Aragorn or Samwise Gamgee or Uncle
Yep.
Iroh. Or even Walter White, which is a more recent one, where
Yep.
you see him as kind of a negative example. Talk to us a little bit about that.
So in terms of, why, masculinity has fallen on hard times, why, people are confused as to what it means to be masculine. I mean, we live in a culture where people don't know what it means to be a man or a woman, let alone how to act
You're not
properly
wrong.
as one.
Yeah.
So no wonder. We just, we've got away from our roots of what it means to be, to be who we are fundamentally. So there's that. But in terms of, masculinity specifically, you have a lot of men who are young men, boys who are raised in single parent households, and that's most often the mother, right? I don't know what percentage it is, but it's a fairly large percentage. I think it's at least a third of kids come from, one parent. I may be wrong. I might be exaggerating that, but it's a significant portion. And then they go to schools where they're largely taught by women. And how can you look at that and go, well, of course, men know what masculinity is. I had someone comment that, I think my Aragorn video maybe a while, long time ago. And it always stuck out to me because he said, oh, every man knows this is what you're supposed to do. Men, most men just don't. And I thought that's a ridiculous thing to say. How could every man know what to do if they're not taught by other men? It's no secret that there is a fatherhood crisis in the country where there just aren't enough fathers actually parenting. So it's got to be a huge, huge part of it. And then, especially in media, there's the subversion, whether in the MCU or wherever, where it's like, well, we're going to have the women assume the men's roles, and it's not that important. What is a man's role? What is a woman's role? And it's all very confusing. And so, there's just the general blurring of the lines is another, big part of what does it mean to be masculine. And that's why when I talk about these, examples of masculinity, I generally don't talk about things. Well, this is what men do and this is what women do, because generally men and women can do the same things. Mm-hmm. Men and women can express the same virtues and should. Every single virtue out there, every single positive character trait belongs in both men and women.
Sure.
You know, men can be nurturing. Men should be nurturing. They should be gentle and loving to their children. Women can be courageous. I've seen my wife give birth 3 times. I will never be that brave. I could go to war tomorrow and I'd still think my wife is the bravest person in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so there's, you know, people try constantly. I see this constantly, and mostly it's my wife telling me about it. She reads far more comments than I do. But you know, she's, you know, people trying to define masculinity by being, you know, forceful, assertive, dominating, whatever. And it's, you know, because people have these kind of twisted ideas like, well, what are men better at? And that's how they define masculinity. It's like, no, masculinity is being virtuous as a man. That's it. That's all there really is to it. That will generally look better, or look not better, look different than being virtuous as a woman, than mm-hmm. being, you know, properly feminine. But to say that, you know, men are assertive, women are assertive too. I'm far less assertive than a lot of women, you know.
I mean, it's to the point where that's a stereotype, like the bossy woman, you know, like, and again, like,
right.
Stereotypes are not reality. Stereotypes are not absolute guides to reality, but like, let's be honest.
They come from somewhere.
Stereotypes happen for a reason. So yeah, absolutely. Like that's, you know, the assertive, aggressive man, that's a stereotype. Mm-hmm. The bossy woman, that's also a stereotype. So, like,
absolutely. So, you know, and so that's why, you know, I try to focus on, okay, you know, what, you know, people want to differentiate between masculinity and femininity, and that's not necessarily a bad thing to do. But I think it gets so murky, because you're just trying to say, oh, what does man do? What does woman do? Well, you know, even the very simple things where say, well, the man is the provider. He provides for his family, you know, his wife, you know, if they're in a, you know, if they're, you know, fortunate enough and blessed with children, his wife should be at home taking care of the children. And I think that is optimal, right? That's the situation in my home. Thank the Lord. Because, you know, I've been blessed with a job that provides for my family. My wife is able to stay home with our children. And that's definitely how we're best suited. But, you know, what if a man can't provide for his family through like a zillion different reasons, mm-hmm. and his wife has to? Is he less of a man because he is at home caring for his children? Is he doing anything wrong? You know, like, you might feel some shame, but that doesn't mean you're in the wrong.
Right.
Right. You're doing what you can with the situation you've been placed into. So as much as, you know, as much as, you know, men want to be providers and they want to be protectors, which are all very good things, or those are very, you know, very masculine things to be that, you don't always have to do it in the archetypal masculine way.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Where again, if you're in a wheelchair, just because you're less able to protect your family doesn't mean you're any less of a man.
Right. Yeah. 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 So, Sam, I like how you defined masculinity there as, you know, being virtuous as a man. Like that's, you know, short and succinct, and based on some of the characters that you described later on in other videos, that really makes a lot of sense. Did I cut you off? I felt like I jumped in there.
No, go ahead.
If you had to, like, take some stories that we're familiar with. So we've been talking some about Lord of the Rings, or maybe even Chronicles of Narnia too, or Avatar, in a story like the Lord of the Rings, who would be your kind of, like an ideal, you know, this is a masculine hero. And, you know, could you compare and contrast, like, who would be the ideal feminine hero in something like Lord of the Rings? And I throw you up those two beach balls because I know you've done work on these. So I figure it'd be pretty easy to talk about.
So, yeah, I mean, the obvious answers, but Lord of the Rings, you could pick any one of the men,
mm-hmm.
any single one, right? You take Sam Gamgee, right? My namesake. There's a reason I picked Samwise. For one thing, it's my name. So I identify with it. But, you know, Sam is, as Tolkien says in one of his letters, he's the chief hero of the story, because in part because he gets like this, the happy ending where he returns home from his journey and marries his, you know, marries Rosie and has 13 children or something like that. And, but, you know, because he is just faithful and devoted to the end. And it's just this incredible example of, you know, what it means to serve virtuously, right? To, you know, and that's something that, again, that's the other thing I was going to say, and you're talking about masculinity that's missing in this culture, is masculinity is about service. And people get this mixed up. I say that thing and they're like, oh, men are just supposed to be slaves. And I'm like, no, femininity is about service too. That's what they're both about. They're about being servants to one another. But I don't talk about femininity as much, so people miss that. So yeah, you see Sam was like, yeah, he is, you know, Frodo's servant, right? He's gardener.
Yeah.
But he's just there for Frodo every step of the way. And, you know, but he's also ultimately devoted to their mission. In the choices of Master Samwise, this chapter of Return of the King, and he thinks Frodo is dead, and he has to choose to take the ring off of Frodo's assumed corpse and continue across Mordor. And like, wow. I mean, because all Sam was just Frodo. He was there for Frodo. He was just with Frodo no matter what.
Yeah.
And now he has to let him go. And he's like, that is just an impossible choice. But he made the right one, even though it was hopeless and he just had no expectation that he'd possibly succeed. Made the right choice. So, you know, again, like you said, softball, you throw that one. So let me talk about Faramir for a little bit, if you don't mind.
No, go for it.
So Faramir, like I said, the one where Jackson didn't really understand what Tolkien was doing with Faramir. So Boromir and Faramir kind of stand as opposites, where Jackson understood that, is that Boromir was favored by Denethor, Faramir was not. But Faramir in the book doesn't really care. Faramir knows what he's about. He knows, you know, how to be a good servant of Gondor and to be a good, you know, just steward of mankind. And he's just an incredibly virtuous man, right? When Frodo shows up with the ring in the book, you know, he says, you know, I would not touch it, not for, I forget the expression he uses, but, you know, not for all the gold in the world. He says something different, you know, because he recognizes that, you know, it's just the evil that is within it, the temptation that it holds. You know, he knows it would overpower him. So he refuses it as easily as any man ever could. And there's something so, so beautiful in that. Where, you know, he's simply able to refuse without a second thought, because that is virtue, right? Mm-hmm. We talk about characters who struggle. Those characters are fantastic. Boromir, amazing, amazing character because of his struggle, because his struggle is so human. It's so relatable, yeah. Right? It's inspiring to see characters like Boromir overcome his, you know, temptation to just to do good, right? He has very good intentions, but to seize power to do good. To see Theoden in the movies overcome his cowardice and his desire to just stay where he's safe, and in order to go and fight the good fight. Those are amazing, and they are virtuous in the end, but they're not virtuous from the start. And that's what virtue truly is. It's the, you know, rejection of any, even, you know, temptation, right? If the temptation comes and it doesn't even get past the front door, it's great if we let the temptation into our living room and then kick it back out.
Right.
It's even better if we don't even answer the doorbell.
Yeah.
Right. That's what Faramir does. And, you know, I've seen people on Twitter or wherever complain that, oh, Faramir is a boring do-goody. And there's a quote from C.S. Lewis from, I think it's The Desolation of Man. Is that what it's called? Gosh, I'm forgetting the quote and the name of the book. But he basically says something along the lines of, you know, we laugh at virtue, or we laugh at courage or something like that, and then wonder why we find men with empty chests. Which is, you know, if you mock someone who, you know, for being a Boy Scout, and then are wondering why everyone's acting like a jerk all the time, well, it's because you made fun of them for acting virtuously.
So that's
another part of it, where, you know, a lot of the time just good behavior in men is not celebrated. Self-serving hedonistic behavior is, and that's another part of why, you know, genuine virtuous masculinity is not understood, because, you know, the men who get the biggest following, someone like Andrew Tate, who have this, you know, the loudest voice, are just self-serving and hedonistic.
Yeah.
So that's another big failing.
Yeah, the you take guys like Aragorn or Sam Gamgee, and another guys too that you've mentioned in other videos, like Uncle Iroh from Avatar: The Last Airbender, and they have such a devotion. I think that's a really good word for it. And devotion, a synonym is something like fidelity. Like they really do have a faithfulness to the right and just cause. Faithfulness to their companions. Like, thank goodness. Like that's one thing that I've loved so much about reading through the books of the Lord of the Rings. You get the notion that the company, that the fellowship is devoted to one another. Like you really do get that in the movies, but you just get so much more through the books, and it's so inspiring. Like it really does remind me of my closest friends who are thankfully fans of the podcast, and I will be joining three of them when we move here next week because. Two of them are professors at the school that I'm going to be going to, and one of them is a youth pastor in town, in the same town where the university is. And so, like that, we have envisioned ourselves as a band of brothers. Another set of stories that I can tell you're a fan of, not just by the decorations on your bookshelf, but also some of the other things that you have mentioned. Right, the helmet back there is from Band of Brothers.
Yep, yeah, that's an airborne helmet.
We've envisioned ourselves as that, and have devoted our lives to getting us all to the same geographic location. So like it's taken 12 years for all of us to get there, but have been able to do so in order to live this fidelity and this devotion to one another. That is so uncharacteristic, you're right, of uncharacteristic in talks of masculinity today. But I think fidelity is a key component there, a key virtue in what true masculinity looks like. Now, I know you've done a little bit on femininity as well. Talk to us a little bit about Eowyn.
Yeah,
In the Lord of the
absolutely.
Rings, and maybe how she demonstrates the same virtues, but in what ways are those different?
So when you talk about, masculinity versus femininity, which again, I don't love to do a lot because people just love to throw out examples like, well, this woman is like this, this man's like this, whatever. But masculinity is generally shaped or is generally ordered toward the world, as in, men shape society. Women tend to shape people, right? And there are like gazillion examples either way. But Eowyn's, femininity in her courage and her devotion, like you said, right? Her faithfulness is so much towards her family. When we see her, when we first are introduced to her, she is there with Theoden, right? She's been there serving him as he grows old, just carrying on him as he's grown old and sick and under the spell of Saruman via Grima Wormtongue, and she's been faithful to him. And you can contrast that with the faithfulness of Éomer, right? Because Éomer has also been faithful to Theoden the whole time. But he hasn't been there. He's been out in Rohan, right? Protecting their lands from the wild men and the orcs who would, attack their villages. And you have these great examples of virtue and, the man and the woman doing different things, but still exceedingly well. I think I make a little joke in my video about Eowyn about, imagine how brave you'd have to be to put up with Grima Wormtongue every single day. And it's like, yeah, that's courage, that's fortitude. It's different, but it's still the same virtue. And so yeah, Eowyn, such a great character. And it's and one that I think was done, you know, pretty well in the movies. There's some bits that, you know, weren't fleshed out as well as I would have liked them to be, but that's the nature of the beast when you're adapting, you know, these books down to even a 4-hour movie.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, you know, her desire for battle is kind of her main driving motivation throughout most of the books. And it's a combination of reasons why she wants it, because she's a complex character. She doesn't just want one thing. She wants to go to battle because the man she loves is going, the men she loves are going to battle, right? Her uncle, who she's loved as a father for many, many years, is going to war. And Aragorn, right? The man she has seen and you know, been rather stricken by, is also going off to war. And you know, she's got the whole conversation with him, like, you know, I'm to be left, you know, to tend the bed. So, you know, for when the men come back home, and you know, if they fall in battle, then you have leave to be burned with the house, so the men need it no more, something like that. And you know, people you like to construe that and be like, oh, if this, you know, Eowyn being feminism, yay, good. Aragorn's being sexist, bad. I don't like putting labels on things, for one thing. And it's like, yeah, wouldn't we feel the same way? You know, if we're, especially, you know, growing up as Eowyn did, you know, learning to ride and to wield a sword, saying, what have I been given these talents for, if not to put them to use in, you know, the world's most desperate moment? And you know, but her second motivation, which is not so good, is she wants to die because she thinks the world is about to end, and she would rather go out riding on the fields of Plenor than waiting for, you know, orcs to descend upon her and Rohan, because that would be more glorious, and her suffering would be, you know, she wouldn't have to suffer in waiting, which she has been for a long time, right? You know, she's been watching her uncle grow old, and just, you know, as the world has darkened, and you know, this is she's like, all right, it's time for this to end. So a large part of her journey is learning to hope, right? To have this hopefulness, which is also part of Theoden's journey. So you know, there's, again, you talk about femininity, we're talking about virtue. That's pretty much all there is to it. Like I said, there. I think I used this quote. I may have stolen it. I think I credited them at least eventually. In my Iroh video, it's The Art of Manliness, which is at least a blog and maybe a podcast too.
He's
But
got a
I've only seen their
podcast
blog.
also, yeah.
Where he says, you know, men and women, you know, are both about virtue, right? This is research I was doing when I was writing my Iroh video. And he says they're, you know, but are they the same? No. Two instruments, you know, playing the same note will sound very different, right? That's how you understand masculine and feminine virtue, right? It's often just expressed in very different ways. So, you know, Eowyn's hopefulness might look a little different than the Theoden's hopefulness. And but yeah, it's beautiful. And then the ending of Eowyn's story, of course, comes when, you know, she has been victorious in battle, right? Defeated with, you know, the aid of Merry, the Witch King, right? An unkillable foe. And you know, then fallen kind of, you know, because she stabbed him, suffered a grievous wound that is healed by Aragorn. She's in the Houses of Healing. And she wants out of there. She wants to go back to war because she still has, you know, no real hope. She's, you know, and which is fair, that it was pretty hopeless. It was not a great situation still. And then she runs into Faramir, who is in the same sort of situation. He is a man of great strength, very capable in battle, but he is patient, right? He is waiting. He's trusting in, you know, in Aragorn and those who have gone off to fight, you know, by the Black Gate. And he's trusting in divine providence that, you know, what will be, you know, we'll face our end, whatever it is. And she's able to find, you know, through him, you know, having that peace, she's able to somewhat to find it herself. And that's, you know, such a great ending, where she's able to kind of let go, to not just charge headfirst to death, because she's just in death, I'll finally find peace. I'll be like, you know, let go of this pain. She's able to find, you know, peace and joy in life. And you know, she at the end, you know, she sets aside her sword, you know, and says, okay, you know, I'm going to be a gardener and a healer. And you know, like, Aragorn is a healer. Sam Gamgee is a gardener. Like, this is such a, you know, such a beautiful ending for any character of Tolkien to have that ending where they're able to live in peace, right? To be healing. Yeah, it's so beautiful. So yeah, Eowyn's just this wonderful character. And like, there's so many pieces of that. Basically everything after her, you know, her battle with the Witch King is not in the movies. And oh, I wish it were, because it's just such a wonderful, happy ending for that character.
It, especially if you know a little something about Tolkien and his love of nature. Like, if you ever get a chance to read through some of his letters, it is no small thing to be heralded as a gardener.
Nope.
In the Lord of the Rings.
Very high honor.
Yeah. Sam, as we wrap up here, maybe just quickly, since we were talking about Eowyn as you know, kind of a prime example of the, you know, femininity, but really the virtue, a woman of virtue here. What makes her, in your opinion, so different from kind of this slew of sort of bland and uninspiring, you know, female leads that have come to dominate movies and TV and comics and culture today? You know, what sets someone like Eowyn apart from some of these others?
The biggest piece is that she's not fighting, at least not wholly for herself. Like I said, she does kind of have this death wish.
Sure.
Where she's got this fatalistic outlook.
Mm-hmm.
But that is also a flaw. That's a big piece. A lot of these, you know, a lot of modern female characters aren't very flawed. At least not really notably. They're just kind of, you know, if they have flaws, it's usually just the people around them keeping them down. You know, the remake of Mulan from 2020, I think, it's just a fantastic example of how to completely botch your source material.
Yeah.
Because, you know, but Eowyn, yeah, she is primarily fighting for her people, for her uncle, her father figure, right? I mean, that, you know, she stands in between him and this unkillable, what we assume, you know, assumedly unkillable foe who causes everyone else to flee. And I think, you know, the only other person who could possibly stand before, you know, the Witch King is Gandalf, right? Everyone else flees. This is a very important point in the books, which, you know, again, the movie kind of misses the point on, is that Gondor was only losing, right? The Men of Minas Tirith were only losing because of the Witch King's presence, right? As soon as, in the book, as soon as Rohan shows up and the Witch King is drawn off by their approach, the men of Gondor rally and sally forth from the gate of Minas Tirith to attack Mordor on the fields of Plenor. And so I mean, that's how oppressive the fear of this creature is. And Eowyn steps in front of him because that's her uncle lying on the ground, right? That's the man she has loved for so many years, who is, you know, she's just taken care of and watched over as he's aged. And I mean, because we know how long she's been with him and how long she's cared for him, we know how much she loves her, because that's what love is. Love is like, is choosing to care for someone day after day, right? Even when, you know, you are a young woman who would love to just go riding, right? To just spend time enjoying yourself. You know, he says, Theoden says, at least in the movie, you know, that she's had this, you know, horrible fate of having to, you know, look after an old man who should have loved her as a father. You know, Eowyn has not had the life that, you know, today's women would want, right? That these, you know, women of fiction that are so often on screen now would want. I mean, she's had this life where she's basically been a servant to a man, and she's still loved him, right? She still steps in front of the most terrifying creature that anyone there has ever set eyes on. She steps in between them. She says, "You like if you you know, like if you kill or if you touch him, I'll kill you." Essentially, you know, I will smite you if you touch him. Whatever the actual line is, I'm drawing a blank. And it's just like that's love, and that's what we want, right? Out of our characters, we want them to love well. That's just what we need. So I feel like I should stop talking because I said that as well as I'm going to.
No, that's all right. I'm gonna butcher this line. My apologies to J.R.R. Tolkien. It's a line from Faramir, right, in the books, that I do not love the sword for its brightness, the arrow for its swiftness, or
I love
the
only that which for which yeah, I love only that which they defend.
I love only that which they defend. And obviously from a Christian perspective, in our discussion of virtue, love and self-sacrifice, those are all core to every other expression of virtue that can be out there. And as should be unsurprising for a lot of people, that it does manifest differently amongst men and women, because often because men and women are different. That should be demonstrable. What has what I also like so much about some of the characters that we've mentioned, some of the female characters that we've mentioned, is they again are just eminently relatable. I mean, they're just so relatable. So, compare, for example, someone like Eowyn or Katara or Toph or Suki or some of these other characters from Avatar: The Last Airbender. I wish I would have mentioned more of that in the notes to prompt you with this evening, because we that has been a fun conversation to bring up Avatar: The Last Airbender. But you think about some of those women. They are flawed, and we've talked about those flaws. And the shows or the movies or the books don't hide their flaws. And yet, they're still able to be likable characters and have flaws, which is a funny thing that I remember seeing about Sokka too, when they I remember seeing some reports out about how the Netflix adaptation toned down Sokka's sexism. It's like, well, I mean, like, yeah, okay, sexism isn't good, but imagine a world where someone is likable and still struggles with some things. Just like, what a concept, right? But if you take, some of the female characters that we've talked about and then compare them to someone like Rey Palpatine slash Skywalker, or the main antagonist and protagonist, the twins from Star Wars, the Acolyte, or some of the leading, some, not all, but some of the leading characters from the more recent Marvel Cinematic Universe. They are flawless, and yet in many ways just unlikable. And one thing that you and I have talked about, that talked about earlier, before we got recording, and one thing that we've seen a lot of is, I don't know, it's not that we don't like women characters. Like, that's not it at all. It's that we don't like badly written characters. And I feel like there's a lot of that has plagued Hollywood some. You want to jump in on that for a moment before we wrap up?
It all comes down to, what are you trying to say with this character? If you're trying to say, look at me, you're going to do a bad job. It's going to be a terrible character. If you're trying to say, look at this character's struggle, look how they overcome them. right? Look at her, you know, use her wits and her intelligence and her creativity to overcome her natural disadvantages, such as the original Mulan, where she was weaker and slower than everyone else because she was a woman. So she had to be better than them. She had to think outside the box. She had to use her creativity to do what no one else could. Right. And then you contrast that with 2020's Mulan, who just had magical chi or whatever, just did everything. And it's like, what kind of a lesson are we trying to teach people here? Because if you're just showing off characters who are essentially perfect, who never really have to struggle with anything, who have no real flaws, even if they're not obnoxious, right? You know, some characters are, especially, you know, like characters like She-Hulk, they're written to be kind of obnoxious, right? To insult their audience.
Wendy in the Peter Pan remake.
Oh, yeah. Oof.
Was kind of obnoxious. Super awkward take there, you know, situation there. Isn't Peter Pan like of Indian descent in that movie?
Yeah, that was just, I think everyone even involved in that movie eventually realized that was a mistake, and that's why I went straight to Disney Plus.
So, like, you know, let's have the white British girl, you know, like chastise and scold and punch the smaller Indian boy. It's like, okay, guys. Y'all did not think about history here. Anyway,
no.
Not they're not obnoxious.
Yeah, they don't have to be obnoxious. Rey is not obnoxious. She's a perfectly fine person.
Yeah.
Her character is just boring. There's very little characterization, at least in part because they didn't plan out that trilogy and they had no idea where it was going.
Yeah.
But also because they just kind of want to be like, you know, people have... I would attribute a lot of the poorly written female characters to sexism, but in kind of the reverse, where it's like, we don't want to offend women. So we're not really going to write them as real people. We're just going to, you know, we're not going to give them the same level of attention that we give to, you know, characters like even Tony Stark or, you know, Cap in the MCU, which they're not the most complex and, you know, interesting characters, but they're still quite well written. They're still, you know, they go through a good bit of development.
Yeah.
And, you know, then you have character and then there's so many other characters. You didn't give them the same level of attention. And that feels kind of sexist.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not going to write your woman with the same, flaws and development opportunities, what are we doing? So, I mean, that's the worst thing you can be as a character in any sort of property is boring. And so many of them just are, because they're not really written to highlight any sort of truth or teach any sort of inspiring lesson. They would say they're empowering. No, they're just powerful. There's a difference. Being naturally powerful is not empowering. They're just kind of written to be there, to be a woman on screen, often once where as a man. Like, and one of the best examples is, what's her name? Riri Williams or something. The girl who takes over as Iron Man in the latest Black Panther movie.
Mm-hmm.
She's
Heart,
just there.
Right?
Ironheart.
Isn't that
what
she's
yeah,
called?
Yeah. She's just there. She's just a girl who's really smart and builds a kind of prototype Iron Man suit. And then the Wakandans give her a full-fledged Iron Man suit. She's just there. That's her character. That's it. And it's, do some work. I'm okay. I would like to like this character. I would like to like all the characters. And you know, that movie had its ups and downs.
Well, even with a character like Shuri in Black Panther, like you see her work and like she's the genius princess. Okay, so she's working with a pretty full deck to begin with, but. Like you even see her kind of work and struggle and you know, figure out how to overcome, you know, some things.
Oh, I mean, her whole quest is, you know, vengeance, at least, you know, after the queen dies, right? Her mother dies and she's, you know, seeking for vengeance against Namor. And I have lots of problems with Namor as a villain. That was the conflict and the plot in that movie doesn't make a lot of sense, but Shuri's, you know, just quest for vengeance that, you know, eventually she realizes it will destroy her. And while the ending was not my favorite of that movie. It's like, yeah, that's a really good element to have in there, at least thematically, where, you know, if you exact vengeance on someone, you destroy two people, essentially. I was glad that was there in that movie, at least. When, yeah, so much of the time, it's just, yeah, they're justified, they're just doing their thing, and it's just kind of like you're supposed to cheer for them, even if they're not, because they're on the good guy's side, they're the hero, even if they're not doing anything particularly heroic.
Yeah. Sam, I really appreciate your time tonight, sir. Tell us where we can find you and follow your work. And if there's anything else that you've got coming up in the near future, you can tell us about.
So Master Samwise on YouTube, as far as I know, it's the only channel with that name. Maybe there are, it's certainly the biggest channel with that name.
Master Samwise _5 has 30 subscribers.
I am on Twitter, but I never really do anything there. So it's really just YouTube. Upcoming, it's kind of whatever I kind of do whatever I want, in terms of quality or in terms of content. I don't upload on a schedule or anything. My current projects, I'm working on a video on God of War Ragnarok, which I had a lengthy video on the first game in that series, and I'll have an even lengthier video on this one, which is because it embodies a lot of the themes we talk about here. Redemption and, the repentance, vengeance, right? Becoming better for the sake of those we love. There's a lot of really, really beautiful themes, and some wonderful characters. So, and some quite well written, the female lead is quite well done. She's strong and she's kind of arrogant and cocky even, but she's still complex and, not always right about everything.
Yeah.
Just a great character to watch her interact with Kratos, the main, the main protagonist of the game. So yeah, that's my next one. That's a lengthy process. I'll be doing a couple of videos about Boromir and Faramir after that. So it's been a little bit since I've done a Lord of the Rings one, and I always got to return to Tolkien because it's just the greatest novel, certainly the greatest novel of the 20th century, if not ever.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, keep us posted when you decide to return to the Chronicles of Narnia, because there's some good stuff in there too. The femininity or the virtue of Lucy Pevensey, that might actually be a pretty worthwhile video. I know I would share that one around.
Yeah, no, that's Lucy's a wonderful, wonderful character. Great feminine archetype. The healer, again, you got Aragorn being kind of the hands of a healer, but that is still, I don't know, it's largely a feminine archetype, and it's just such a beautiful thing when, in fiction or in real life, just this, it's this wonderful ability that women have. It's kind of funny, isn't it, that despite the vast majority of physicians, doctors, and everything in history being men, if you think about notable medical figures, you think of like Florence Nightingale and Clara Barton, like right off the top of my head, at least, when it comes to, because they were kind of in the thick of it and, healing when men needed it the most. And, that's what I think of when I think of Lucy. So,
yep. My wife is a physical therapist, and three of my sisters-in-law are nurses of various kinds. So
my wife is a nurse.
I totally get it. Yeah, totally get it. Well, Sam, thank you so much for your time this evening. I will put a link in the description to your channel and encourage people to check out your stuff.
Okay, well, thank you so much for having me, Kevin. This has been an honor and just an absolute blast.